This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Once you start noticing it, pretty much every single TV drama, Netflix drama or whatever, and film that deals in dark subject matter looks a bit like Seven. And it wasn't the case before Seven came along. They didn't look like this.
This is episode 84. Hello, film fans. In the studio today, we have Boyd.
Hello.
Josh.
Hey.
And as always, Kobe.
All right.
And we are reviewing the David Fincher film, Seven.
And if you want to hear more about us or read more about us online, come to our website, flixwatcher.tv, visit us and join in the banter with us on Twitter at flixwatcherpod, and head over to iTunes, subscribe to us, review us, and share with your friends.
There will be spoilers and bad language. You have been warned. Hello, and welcome to this episode of Flixwatcher Podcast. We have today Boyd and Josh. If you would like to tell our listeners about the podcasts that you do and do together, please.
Sure. The podcast we do together, which is the only podcast I do, is Footballistically Arsenal, which is a weekly look at what is going on at Arsenal Football Club. So fans of North London's finest team will enjoy it. And some general football fans occasionally probably listen, but it's mainly Arsenal fans. So you can find us at Arsenal Podcast on Twitter or footballisticallyarsenal.net.
And who do you have players and stuff that come on the podcast?
Or? We have a mix. We have some journalists who follow Arsenal, fans who have come from interesting backgrounds, I would say, on the whole, people that are involved in journalism or PR or other associated fans, ex-players sometimes.
Metropolitan media elite.
Basically, I'll explain. There is something called club level at Arsenal, which is basically not standard seating, which is where Boyd sits. I sit in the standard seating. But Boyd described this podcast 8 years ago when he started it as the club level podcast. Mm. So it is unashamedly the sort of middle class Arsenal podcast.
Fair enough. That's fair enough, yeah.
And who are you?
I am Boyd Hilton. I also, I'm still doing the Footballistic Arsenal podcast with Josh. I also host Basic Bingers, which is a weekly pop culture kind of chat and review show. And I am on the Pilot TV podcast, which is a weekly high-end TV review and recommendation curation. How about that? I'm going to use that word.
Yeah, I like it.
Podcast. And every fortnight, I do the GQ Strike podcast, which is a general football chat with my great friend Elga Johnson, and we kind of do that together.
You've been talking a lot on Pilot TV about Doctor Who, the new Doctor. I missed completely Peter Capaldi. I don't know
Did
why.
You?
I just weren't
interested. I was too old for you.
That's it. I was interested, but then I think I dipped out of Matt Smith, and Peter Capaldi didn't revive me.
Right.
But I do want to come back in with a new Doctor. I'm not seeing any episodes.
You've got to come back, yeah. I love all Doctor Who, as you can tell from this, if you listen to that podcast. But there was definitely a sense that the last few years have been very much, you know, there've been a lot of like dense storytelling that refers to, you know, the whole history of Doctor Who in a brilliant way, I think. But now it does feel like you could watch it fresh, and you know, you don't have to have been a Whovian.
Particularly all the way through.
Yeah, all the way through. And Jodie Whittaker's just brilliant. Yeah.
That's my problem. Is I feel that I need to watch them all again. I'm happy to watch.
You don't need to, honestly.
I'll pick back up again.
Yeah.
Right. Boyd, you were the one that chose the film for today, which is Seven.
And can we just say that at this point, if you haven't seen Seven before and you have got any interest in seeing it, then stop listening now, because we are going to do spoilers and if you kind of know what happens, then just stop listening if you haven't seen it.
Stop listening if you haven't seen it. Come back after.
Yeah, because I'm definitely going to talk about the ending. I mean, because the ending is such, it's one of the most extraordinary endings in cinema history, I think. And it has to be discussed. There's no point. Part of the reason why I chose it is so that we can discuss the ending, because it came out more than 20 years ago. So I think by now, you know, it's not like...
There's got to be a limitation.
What's the statute of limitations of spoilers? People still get annoyed if feedback. You quite rightly warn them. So partly that's why I picked it, yeah, about to do with the ending. Shall I just want to explain in my 2 minutes?
Two minute synopsis, please.
Retiring police detective William Somerset, played by the great Morgan Freeman, is tackling what he thinks is going to be his last case. And he's been lumbered with a newbie called David Mills, played by Brad Pitt, young Brad Pitt. And together they're investigating some particularly grisly murders. And it turns out that they are all being done by a serial killer who is following the seven deadly sins. So all of these murders are being kind of staged, if you like, to reflect upon the seven deadly sins. And it's partly the story is them working out what the link is between all of these different horrendous, disgusting murders that kind of almost mount in levels of disgustingness and obscenity. And it's partly looking at, in the end, that it's not really a kind of whodunit, because, of course, the fascinating situation is that the actual killer, the John Doe figure, who, you know, is given that random name, played by a certain Kevin Spacey, just reveals himself as being the killer. So they didn't even do much detective work to find him in the end. He just reveals himself. And there's also the very important fact that the young Detective Mills' wife, Tracy, is played by the great Gwyneth Paltrow. And in the end, she becomes embroiled in the story in the most extraordinary manner, in the ending to which I've already referred. And that is Seven.
And that's 2 minutes.
I wasn't timing myself.
It's all good. It's all good. Guys, let's do a quick sweep of the table. How many times have we seen this? It's 20 years old. 1995 it came out.
Yeah.
So 23 years ago. This is my third or fourth time watching, I think.
Oh, crikey. I must be 10 plus.
Now, so part of the reason why I've chosen it is I watch it regularly. There are certain films that I watch almost every 6 months.
Yeah.
And this is one of them. So I think I've probably seen it at least 20 times.
Whoa.
Once. And I couldn't help notice.
This time.
So you hadn't seen it until I forced you to watch it. But I noticed that, did you see this? The producer, who's Arnold Copleson, died 2 weeks ago. Just died. So it's interesting that you chose it right this time. So it was my first time. I'd never seen it. And I'm delighted you chose it, Boyd. It was a great watch, unsurprisingly. And amazing, you know, just, you know, huge names in the film industry. You know, all in that film, a 22, 23-year-old Gwyneth Paltrow, Brad Pitt in his early 30s. Yeah, I just checked. She was born in 1972, so she'd have been 23. Yeah.
Oh, shit.
I mean, tell us more about your experience, because
I saw it when it came out in the cinema. Mm-hmm. I remember it very clearly and being absolutely bowled over by it. And part of the reason why I've seen it every 20 times at least, probably, I'm sure it's more than that, it would be in my top 10 films of all time. I'm putting my cards on the table now. And it's one of the most recent films on my 20 favorite films of all time. You know, I know you did Pulp Fiction on this show, but I probably wouldn't have Pulp Fiction. I'm not one of those, like, you know, oh, it's all films from the 90s, you know, they're in your top favorite films of all time, you know, but.
I've got a range. We've got some 80s in there.
I'm not slagging off. By the way, I'm not slagging off anyone who picks Pulp Fiction. That's fine. But for me, this is a timeless piece of classic filmmaking. I was lucky enough to host a BAFTA tribute to David Fincher, the director, in which I interviewed him on stage for an hour and a half about his whole career. And when I was asked to do it, it was literally one of the greatest moments of my life, because I like all his films. There's not one film he's done which I don't like, but this is definitely my favourite, and this is, you know, for me, his masterpiece. And so when I interviewed him on stage, just talking to him about it, like, it was like I could barely control my excitement, so I had to kind of calm down. And he was very sweet, you know, he was like, clearly, like, and he was, and that's the whole story of it, scripted by a guy called Andrew Kevin Walker. And so we have to talk about the end. It's beautifully filmed. Cinematography by Darius Conji is incredible. It has influenced, I think, the whole genre of crime thriller, not just serial killer, but in every way, particularly visually. This whole greeny, browny, grimy look of it.
I was watching it now and I was like, that's all over Breaking Bad.
Right.
Of course, exactly.
The bleach bypass, I think they call it.
Thank you.
And the camera angles and things like that. That's like...
The whole way it's filmed, exactly. It visually, you know, and you look at every... And I pretty much, I guarantee, once you start noticing it, pretty much every single TV drama, Netflix drama or whatever, and film that deals in dark subject matter looks a bit like Seven. And it wasn't the case before Seven came along. They didn't look like this. It's like it's established this... Fascinating, and just the way it uses focus, it kind of edges of the screen sometimes are out of focus.
Right. I'm trying to think what happened before then.
Yeah, well, films just looked kind of normal colors. Basically, sure. There's a kind of drained quality to the color, beautiful in a beautiful sense, and the kind of and I also am talking about the kind of imagery of the rain. It's raining all the time. It rains all the time now in crime dramas. It didn't rain all the time before Seven. All of that stuff. It all comes from this. Conception of this film, I think.
I know this was shot in LA, but where is it actually set? Is it not? Is it a nondescript?
Set in a
place?
Nameless city.
It's based on New York.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like New York. Yeah. It feels a bit like Philadelphia, I think, as well.
Yeah.
But it's it isn't named. So it's like the whole thing is standing in for the kind of sickness of modern society. You know, particularly when you meet the killer, Paper Kevin Spacey. And the one thing, I could go on, clearly, as you can tell already, I can go on about it for weeks on end, but you know, I don't want to bore Josh particularly because he listens to me talking about Arsenal like this every week. But the end, this ending, so the whole, I think the whole film is
let's go to the end.
Is extraordinary.
Let's go to the end.
But the fascinating thing about the ending is the famous ending with the thing in the head in the box, Gwyneth Paltrow's head is in the box. This is the climax of the film. And which then leads Brad Pitt to kill the killer, played by Kevin Spacey, is what the killer wants him to do. That's his final act.
And that's the seventh sin.
That's the seventh sin.
Yeah.
Brilliantly, the original producers and financiers of the film rejected that ending by Andrew Kevin Walker. They thought viewers cannot deal with Gwyneth Paltrow's head in a box. So they ditched that ending officially. They'd rejigged it so that it was actually going to be the two detectives and it raced against time to find her, who had been kidnapped or whatever, or she was in some situation held captive by the killer. But they accidentally sent David Fincher the wrong script. They sent him the original script by accident. So he read and he's like, I'm doing this film. He'd almost decided to do it because of that extraordinary ending. And he wanted, his original conception was, as soon as the head in the box, as soon as Brad Pitt finds out that it's Gwyneth Paltrow's head in his box, he then shoots Kevin Spacey and then it goes to black immediately and there's nothing else. Whereas in the final version of the film, there's a coda where the other detective kind of talks about, as a philosophical few lines about the state of the world and the universe to give it a little bit of optimism.
A bit of a Hemingway.
Yeah, right. Yes. So imagine, imagine if the whole bleakness had just literally stopped there, fade to black, and that's it. Boom. That would have been even more incredible, but it's still pretty incredible.
First time watching, Josh, what did you know about it beforehand? Did you know about the head in the box or the ending?
So I'll come clean, because there were some tweets asking for reviews. There was a couple of things that came into my notifications which referred to, it's obviously her head in the box. So I sort of saw it coming, which I might not have otherwise
done. We need to think about this for next time.
It's all right. You can edit this out. So I sort of knew it was coming, but still there was the horror and it's the van and it's speeding and you're not quite sure, has he come to sort of, with some breaking news or to save it? You're not sure what the van's doing and that the guy in the van is actually completely innocent, that he's come with this head. I mean, it's incredibly clever. I mean, the whole film has that lovely kind of mix between the two detectives. Somerset and Mills of experience and youth, and they sort of, there's that, tension between them at the beginning, but gradually by the end of the film there's sort of that unity of working together for the greater good, and the old wise head trying to eventually persuade the younger, sort of, clearly, wrapped up in the situation, younger detective of, to take a different path and not let the film conclude as you realise it kind of will. I think that's sort of fair. But an absolute classic. Loved it. Clever. Some amazing performances. Particularly Spacey.
Where do you fall on crime dramas? Do you watch many of them generally, or
not huge? I wouldn't say huge. I don't think you'd have you know, I wonder, I was saying, when I was thinking just when I was watching it, when would I have otherwise sat and watched this? Had we not been in this environment, had Boyd not suggested, I don't know if I'd have got round to it. I might never have. So I'm glad I did. But yeah, I wouldn't, this isn't my typical...
Fair. Because I was thinking again, just when you were saying now, I'm looking at some of the pictures we have on the screen. I mean, True Detective has got a lot from this.
A huge amount, yeah. It's
stunning. Helen, what, is it this or is it Fight Club for you in terms of Fincher?
I mean, Fight Club is like more than a five for me.
out of five?
Yeah. You know, Fight Club is the one for me, but... This, I remember, I'd never seen anything like this.
Mm. Did you see it at the cinema yourself?
I didn't know, because at the time where I was living, there wasn't actually a cinema. We didn't have a cinema for about a year and a year or so. So I unfortunately missed that. But I mean, it's brilliant and it's really dark. And, you know, at the time, Kevin Spacey had just made The Usual Suspects. So those two came out at the same time, and kind of the way they didn't market him was brilliant.
Uncredited, yeah.
I mean, the opening credits, it's a brilliant. Nine Inch Nails and just the editing, it just sets the mood for the whole film.
Was this where he started working with Trent Reznor?
Yes, it was. And if you notice, the closing credits go the wrong way.
Yeah.
They don't go down, they go up. The whole thing, yeah, everything. I mean,
All those little touches make it, and you know, there's some brilliant lines in it. Like, this isn't going to have a happy ending. And I was doing a little bit of reading. So apparently, Sylvester Stallone turned down the role that Brad Pitt took, and potentially it could have been Al Pacino in the Morgan Freeman role, which shows you just how sort of pivotal the casting of this, because obviously Brad Pitt was just trying to sort of make himself be taken a bit more seriously.
So let's talk about these actors at the moment. Where were they in their ascendancy or not? Start with Brad Pitt. He was this post Thelma?
Yeah, so it was post that. I think it was post 7 years in Tibet kind of time.
He was a pretty big star by then, I would say. Yeah, he was definitely like a young
was a Quentin Tarantino scripted one. True Romance.
True Romance, yeah. But before Fight Club, obviously, for their relationship. So he was just kind of trying not to be the romantic lead a little bit.
Yeah. Spacey. Siri.
Thanks, Siri, for your input on that one. So Kevin Spacey had basically, The Usual Suspects had just come out, pretty much. So he was upon mega stardom, really, with that.
I think had he been in the title card,
Everyone would be like, it's going to be him again.
Yeah. This is post See No Evil, Hear No Evil, which is a favourite Kevin Spacey film of mine.
One thing I wanted to say, because obviously, like, there, you know, the crimes in it are horrific, but it's not violent because most of the violence happens off screen.
Yeah.
It's not violent, but it's grim.
Yeah, it's grim. It's really grim, not violent.
Yeah. You don't see it.
No. And you don't see the head in the box, which is brilliant in that. If you saw the head in the box, then it would instantly lose its value, because you've just got everyone's reaction and the realisation, which is much worse than any, you know, CGI.
What rating was this when it's freaking out?
18.
It was an 18?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's... Clearly. I mean, you can't show people being murdered in that way without being an 18.
Well, I think nowadays it might be a 15.
I think it would be a 15.
Really?
Yeah, because
it's all implied rather than
because it's all there is very little actual violence. It's all happened. Mm. They are investigated. And the other thing about it is that I need to check. It might have been a 15. I don't know. But maybe the British Film Sessions were in it. They have different certificates for home video, of course, and theatrical release sometimes. But I was going to say about the lack of violence in the film, but even the crimes, even the murders, are not they're mostly men, which is quite rare in the world of crime fiction, because a lot of crime thrillers revolve around the slaughter of women and the stalking of women, and that's become a kind of, you know, an issue, quite rightly. But this, you know, doesn't go along with that. It's the victim, the insanity, the psychopathy of Kevin Spacey's character is so intriguing and kind of what's the word I'm looking for? It's just not your standard, you know, serial killer
And yet now, from that, after this film, it did become very much kind of, so it feel, a lot of the things that happen in this film maybe feel to I think to new viewers might feel a little bit cliched.
Sure.
Yeah.
Because you've seen, but you only, because they all came after this, as I keep going about how I genuinely feel Seven is one of the most influential films of all time, because so many films have copied it and been so similar.
I mean, rewatching again, is just, there is so many things in there. Where was Morgan Freeman and Gwyneth? Was this Gwyneth's first role?
No, she'd done a few. She'd done like maybe Great Expectations before then. I'm trying to think what else.
And Morgan Freeman had been in quite, I mean, he was, you know, he'd been in a lot of...
Post Shawshank or before.
He wasn't quite the mega star that he became after it. He was just kind of like one of those, you know, oh yeah, Morgan Freeman, this was like a major like role for him.
Well, I think he's still, the other thing is the influence he's had on his career, because I still think the Morgan Freeman persona, you know, all those voiceovers he does, that incredible voice, that kind of...
March of the Penguins.
Exactly. Steeped in dignity. It's like, exudes dignity. The whole character from start to finish in this film, it's all about he is, the you know, he's the kind of principled, unbelievably, you know, moral, figure of moral authority. And that's all in his voice. And I mean, you can't imagine. I mean, it's interesting about the casting, because I did know that about Al Pacino, but thank God. I mean, I love Al Pacino, but I don't feel anyone. This is like, you know, I do feel that the film has influenced Morgan Freeman's personality in that, you know, he's become kind of, he's almost become like this character now.
I mean, there's some of the shots in this and some of the scenes in this, just the more simple ones, like in the library. He's there getting them. I've never seen someone getting books from a library so well shot and so well. And then they put the security guards are playing poker, and they put the classical music on, and that just completely lovely sets the whole thing off. You've got the green lamps, you've got Morgan Freeman just spotlit and all this kind of music, and that just ties in with the horror that's going around, the kind of psychological horror, because it's not like that explicit. And it's just, it all comes together to be one. This is a true masterpiece, really. There's no...
Oh, every single shot, I think, is perfect, yeah. And it also, it doesn't kind of... like, every scene, I think, works narratively. It's either advancing the story or telling us more about the character. So even, you know, there's a great scene where Morgan Freeman goes and has dinner at Brad Pitt and Gwyneth Paltrow's flat, which is near a rail, under the train. The train runs under it, so they constantly have this rumbling of the train. That is so perfectly judged, that scene, because it feels completely believable. Gwyneth Paltrow, tiny, very small role, but key, because she ends up with her head in the box. But you like her immediately. She's incredibly likable. So finely judged. You know, every single scene kind of fits perfectly, and every shot is beautiful. And I'm thinking, there's one shot that I always remember, which is, I'll stop going on about it in a minute, but there's one shot where, quite early on, where it's raining as it will practically is throughout the film, and they're just going in a cop car. Mm. And I think it's when Brad Pitt's talking about how he shot someone once. And there's a incredible lighting effect that happens. It's almost like a little kind of rainbow thing happens, and there's like a screen flare with a light, and it's like a stunning little moment. Just bits like that. It's like, it's a genre film that is directed like it's directing the most important, you know, kind of story that's ever been told. That's what I love about it.
Well, Darius Conji, he's, I can think of Delicatessen off the top of my head.
Yeah, that was his big film that he got this job from doing Delicatessen. Which is a stunning looking film.
Before, I want to ask everyone what for them was the worst of the sins. For Fincher, this, he came after Alien 3,
he was never going to make a film again. And it was this script that
pulled him back out.
Yeah.
And that would have been a massive loss for
cinema, for me personally as well. So
definitely.
So you said, Boyd, you love all his films.
Yes.
Is this your favourite of his films?
This is my favourite of his films. I mean, it's interesting you mentioning Fight Club. So I absolutely love Fight Club. But what I'd say is, I think the reason why I put this above Fight Club, I think Fight Club is slightly dated, a little bit dated, because it does touch upon, you know, there's all the IKEA references and all that stuff.
Right.
This is timeless. So there's a reason why the city is not named. There's a reason why there's no references to anything at all. In fact, at some points it feels, you know, there's no like mobile phone. It feels almost like when they're going to that like almost desert place somehow from this city, you know, with the whirring wind turbines and all that, it just feels like just a kind of place frozen in time. That's what I love about it. You know, it could have been made any point. The story could be taking place almost any point. And I love that about it. And I feel that's what elevates it to classic status above, even above other David Fincher films that I love, like Fight Club.
I mean, we've had Social Network's been chosen in the pod.
Brilliant film, yeah.
I'm still disappointed there's no further Girl with the Dragon Tattoo films from him.
Yeah, I missed opportunity there.
I would have liked to round it out the trilogy.
Yeah, I did ask him, but I think he felt that he'd done all he could do with that those characters in that, and that character particularly,
yeah.
And that kind of. I mean, he's incredible. He's done a lot of serial killing films.
Sure,
for someone, you know, he really. But he's like
he should do with some comedy, really lighten up a little bit.
Yeah, I think, but there is comedy. If you see Gone Girl, which is probably my second favorite, actually.
Okay,
I absolutely
that
love
freaked
Gone
me
Girl.
Out. I was watching that with my wife in the cinema.
It's good just, that.
Gone Girl is. Another, it's perfect, yeah. Perfect telling of that story. But if you watch, what was I saying about? I was comparing it to the way he tells that story is not a serial killer, but it almost feels like it's in that genre. And that's another, and so even these films that aren't serial killer films that are still dealing with crime and killing and murder and psychopathy, to an incredible extent. But I think it's brilliant he managed to deal with the same kind of subject matter.
And yet
make completely different, brilliant films. At the same time, some people think his masterpiece is, The True Life, Zodiac.
Okay, yeah.
That is great.
It's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. A lot of people think that's his greatest film. You know, but it is fantastic.
It does retread a lot of the things that he paved the way for in Seven.
Absolutely.
I was going to say, I think sort of the bottom of the list for me is probably The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that, yeah. That's my least favourite, yeah. Well, you know what? The Game is brilliant. I love The Game, which is perhaps a bit underrated.
I mean, I even like Alien 3.
Yeah, I quite like Alien 3.
I can't remember seeing it.
He likes Alien 3 now more, I think, than he did at the time.
It was the experience,
wasn't it? Yeah, it was the experience that was terrible, yeah.
Because he's come from a background of making music videos, wasn't he?
Yeah, he directed Madonna, brilliant videos. Madonna, one of my best videos of all time, George Michael's classic one with all the supermodels. He directed that one.
I can't remember.
Freedom.
Freedom, okay, Freedom yeah. 90.
Freedom 90.
Yeah.
Absolute classic, yeah. Sorry, Josh.
Josh, there are seven deadly sins: gluttony, greed, sloth, envy, wrath, pride, and lust. Which of these depictions was the most striking to you?
Well, the one that sticks in the mind, I think, is with the hugely obese man who
gluttony
is
at the start.
Yeah, the
gluttony,
because you've got all their. Is it all the tomato cans? Soup? I mean, is it clearly an amount not for personal use? You know, to the average man. I guess just the. Seeing physically that sort of sticks the memory, sort of sets the tone off on where the film's going. It just I mean, it's an unusual way to go. Cutting someone up, or it's a bit more mainstream. Some of the ones that
mainstream
steady.
Well, I don't know about mainstream, but like I don't know. Ultimately, I know that the last one with it's with a blade. I mean, it's horrific the nature of it, but I think it would take if you go top 10 ways to kill someone, you'd take a while before you go force feeding them.
Yeah, but it's a strap on.
Yeah,
I agree. I mean, that was my second
device.
It's unusual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Boyd, what was your...
Well, I think the scene where they discover the guy that's been strapped to the bed for a year.
What was that? Was that Wrath?
Sloth. Which is Sloth. Sorry, Sloth. It's actually Sloth.
Yeah, Wrath is Brad Pitt's killing him at the end.
Yeah, and that's very clever because you think they've discovered him dead, this corpse, this emaciated, horrendous, skeletal corpse, and he's actually still alive.
So what was that like in the cinema? Because that was a jump scare?
Brilliant jump scare. And a jump scare that, almost like the perfect jump scare because it actually makes sense.
Yeah.
And it story-wise, it actually, the characters in it are jumping because it's terrifying. And it's a shock and it's brilliantly done. And that gets me every time I've seen it, even after 20 viewings.
For yourself?
I mean, it's a competition between Sloth and Lust. I think the Sloth one is great because obviously you do think he's going to be dead and he's not. And the fact that he's alive is more terrifying than the fact that he's dead to be in that state. And then Lust, because you only see the Polaroid for the briefest of seconds and all that violence has happened off screen and you're left with, I think it's Leland Orson's confession.
Yeah.
To kind of build that. And it is just really horrific. I mean, none of these deaths are pleasant deaths.
No.
So, I mean, this is like the worst. And then, it's so clever that the last two are committed in the one scene because you kind of think, there's going to be one every day and you're like waiting for the other two. You're like, well, are we going to have two bodies? How's it going to work? It's like, no, Brad Pitt becomes one of them. And it's just so... clever, which if you haven't seen it and you're like, well, it's not really that clever, but you know, at the time it was amazing.
I think that's probably why I would still perhaps push this towards an 18, because that psychological aspect must be super high in there.
Yeah.
Even though, like I say, it's graphic but not super gory. Mm. The sloth scene is still the one for me that's like,
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
It's Dr. Cox, what, John C. McGinley?
He's the SWAT team leader. Yeah.
Who gets kind of like sloth cough in his face.
Oh, dear.
Guys, we head to the scores.
Absolutely.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
So we will start with you, Boyd, because you picked the film, and we'll start off with the recommendability score, please. And these are all out of 5.
Oh, it's obviously got to be 5.
No further comments.
I just feel that... in the 20-something, nearly 25 years since it came out, I've recommended it to every person I've ever... met who hasn't seen it, and no one's.
Did you not? Did you know that Josh hadn't seen it until?
I didn't know. I didn't talk to Josh about films, so we don't really. Yeah, so I had no idea. But you know, I thought, and maybe he hadn't seen it. I thought it's a possibility he hadn't seen it because
he's got that kind of face.
He's got that kind of face. Yeah,
but, innocent.
Yeah, exactly. So
never seen an 18. Never mind this particular 18.
So just I've never heard anyone disappointed, even when I. Sing its praises to an extraordinary extent.
I think if I don't recommend it to people, it's because I don't think
they've not seen it.
Yeah, it's like, well, you've lived, Josh.
Yeah, I'd be scared of now asking someone if they haven't seen it for fear of the assumptions of what that would mean that I was asking them. I think 4.5. I think it's I think if you're going to watch a film in this, you know, of this type, it's an exceptionally strong choice and clever. So 4.5.
Helen.
It's got to be a 5. I mean, Fight Club is probably my personal favourite, but this is David Fincher's best film. And, you know, it's as brilliant as it was back in 1995.
I'm going for 4.75. there are people who will be appalled by this.
Well, I'm going to be for a start.
You're not going to recommend it to like a 7-year-old.
No, but that's
are you?
That's how I get. That's how I configure my scoring.
Oh, I see what you mean. You're thinking. Yeah. Oh, you're, sorry. I thought you meant now and now will be appalled. You've taken off 0.25 from the.
I mean, I'm appalled.
Yeah. But you mean people will be appalled because of the subject matter?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough.
Because my scoring system is Back to the Future. You can recommend to literally absolutely anyone.
Right.
If they've not seen it.
Yeah.
And then I kind of like to rate it based on.
Okay.
How that.
Yeah, it's definitely not like Back to the Future.
No. Okay, repeat viewing score. Well, Boyd.
I've seen it more than 20 times. So, but just to say, I do think, so I have a whole thing about repeat viewing. I think it's very good that you have repeat viewing as a category, because that is my ultimate test of how good a film is and how much I like it. For example, like, you know, when the Oscar season comes around, it's arriving right now as we're recording this.
There's a lot of films coming out. London Film Festival's just finished.
Too many films and not enough.
So many
hours
films,
to
right?
See
so
them
it's
in.
Very hard sometimes when you. Sometimes in my job, watching 2-3 films in a day, that does happen. And it might be they're all actually really good. So when I'm thinking, well, the ultimate test for me is always, do I really want to watch this again? And will I enjoy the experience of watching it again?
Yeah.
And often, like really brilliant films, I'm trying to think of one that I've seen recently.
Shape of Water,
yeah. Never want to see that again, ever.
Okay.
It's too long.
Right, that's a really good example. It won the Best Picture last year, actually. And I really liked it, but I'm happy enough to see it again.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'd particularly enjoy seeing it again. First Man, you know, so the recent First Man on the Moon, really loved it. I think it's brilliantly done, but I don't want to see that again either. Too much shattering metal rocket action.
Sure.
But it's brilliant.
I've seen it twice.
Oh, there you go.
So I saw it the first time at an advanced screening with a Q&A with space scientists.
Yeah.
And because my wife and I have seen all the Damien Chazelle films before, we're like, okay, I'll go with it. But this time, the only screen we could go to was the 4DX one, where you're moving around
really shattering
moving around in the stupid seats.
Action. Yeah.
And that just took everything away from it. I just felt so sorry for her that she didn't get the same experience.
Yeah. There's a very long-winded way of saying seven, because it is so beautifully put together, even though the subject matter is so grim, there's still humanity in it and humor in it. And I love watching it. And it could even be coming on, you know, randomly. In fact, it was on recently, actually. I didn't realize it was on actual TV.
I think the podcast you've been on, sorry, the show you've been on a few times, they had as TV.
On Entertainment,
Entertainment.
Yeah, Mark Como. So it was actually on normal TV. If I'd have accidentally ended up, I would have carried on watching it to the end. I always do, even though I've seen it 20 times.
Short time, I called it.
Yeah, total 5 out of 5. Yeah. And it's one of the ultimate repeatable viewings for me.
Josh?
Yeah, I think there's a lot you can pick up from it. And, you know, just listening to the way that Boyd and three of you have watched it multiple times and pulling out different themes. I already would like to watch it again. Might give it, you know, a couple of months before I get back to it. But, having I think, obviously, I mentioned earlier that I was aware what we might be leading to with the head at the end. But I think then having watched it properly, once you then do watch it in a different way, I can imagine watching it in a very different way the second time. So I would definitely watch it again. So I think I'm going to be consistent there with another 4.5.
Helen?
So the fact that I can't remember how many times I've seen it, because I've seen it so many, I mean, stands up to how rewatchable it is. Yeah, and also it rewards you for watching it again, because when you watch it again, you kind of can see them, because Kevin Spacey does appear before the actual space.
It's nice seeing him.
And you can, like, oh yeah, he was there. And there's lots of other things, like, you know, that he reads the Cliff Notes and or whatever the American version is. And there's just loads of little things. And because everything's shot so beautifully as well, it's just a kind of a slightly strange pleasure to the eyes to see how well it's filmed with moments of horrificness in between.
Yeah.
So that's a 5.
Yes, please.
I'm going for a 4.5, I think. I haven't seen it as many times as you guys. I don't know why, because it's the kind of time when it would have been on DVD, and when you had limited DVDs, you would have watched it loads of times. But I just think there's a slight edge that I probably wouldn't watch it so much. But I think it's, you know, it's up there. It's up there. Small screen score. This is where I feel it might lose some points for me anyway. Boyd.
I think I might have said this before last time I did this podcast. My small screen is 78 inches, so it's quite a big small screen.
Sure.
But I have watched it on smaller screens. I have actually watched it. I think I watched it on a plane once. It's the storytelling and everything. So even this is a stunning visual achievement. And it has to be demanded to be seen on the big screen. It actually does work on TV perfectly well, because everything exits such a strong thing. So I'm not going to give it 5, but equally, I'm only going to mark it down to 4.5, because it still works on a small screen, as any absolute classic film does.
I'll go with a 4, I think, just very slightly lower. I mean, the characters are so strong, and you sort of stick with them, I think, even on a smaller screen. But yet you have that, particularly, I guess, we're thinking of the ending, the, you know, incredible location, and you would like to watch that on a on a bigger screen. But, you know, particularly, I think, you know, I hadn't seen the film before, and you know, but I've watched numerous films with someone like Morgan Freeman. But just, you know, the character, this experience, this idea that, you know, the young guy can't work it out, that older guy is going into a library, and it can be worked out and they can find a solution. The characters are strong enough that it carries, so I'm going 4.
Helen?
I am also going to go for a 4. I mean, I would love to have seen this at the cinema when it came out, to be part of that first wave of, what the fuck is this? He's still alive. What's in the box? Oh my God.
What's in the box?
But just the way that it's shot, and it's got kind of this really claustrophobic feel as well when they're in the city, and the soundtrack's really interesting, because we've got this kind of sort of white noise of the city, which is constant screaming and cars and the rain and traffic and just this overwhelming noise. And then you've also got like the Howard Shore score as well, which kind of gives this real drama and presence. So as long as you're watching it on a screen where you've got the right contrast and light and balance, so that, you know, you really get to see the colours. You're not watching it with your brightness up on your phone or anything like that, and that you can listen to the score properly. I still think it works as that as well. So four.
I'm going a bit lower than you guys. I'm going for 3.5. I was watching again. It must have been the first time in maybe a decade watching it. I was blown away by what I was seeing on the screen. And many times I was thinking, fuck, I'd like to see this on a bigger screen. Maybe my contrast wasn't right.
Helen. Maybe.
Maybe the contrast wasn't right. But it was just, there was just so many times, even in the dark setting, you're in the house, you're in the dark houses, but they're still perfectly lit and perfectly shot. And that for me is like the high watermark of like superb cinematography. This is pre-digital. So they didn't have that kind of contrast ratio.
Thank
so
God.
Much. Yeah.
Because it's beautifully shot on 35mm film.
So,
Starts off dark, gets lighter, which is very interesting. Other thing.
True, finish off on a lighter note.
Just saying.
Engagement score. Boyd.
I'm going to shock you here by giving it 5. I mean, yeah. I mean, the storytelling. The script, again, you know, it is rare to match. The script by Andrew Kevin Walker is an absolute cast iron classic piece of film writing.
I'm not familiar with his work, Andrew Kevin Walker.
He's done a huge amount, right. Has to be said.
So I think he did Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which was great. I think he's a very specific, you know, I credit him with not doing a huge amount, almost by choice. You know.
So he wrote Fight Club.
Oh, there you go.
No, not Fight Club. He wrote Seven. What's he else involved in?
He did
Wolfman.
On Fight Club, it says here, uncredited script doctor.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, so it's probably one of these people that's shopped in to work on.
8mm, he wrote, 8mm, which is another serial killer film. Which
I fell asleep during that.
Joel Schumacher badly directed it, but actually is a good script. I have to say.
He also wrote The Wolfman, Benicio Del Toro werewolf classic.
Yeah. And I think he also worked on Panic Room, another great David Fincher film.
That's one I haven't seen still.
He's really good on Twitter, Andrew Kevin Walker, by the way. I'm interested on Twitter.
Fincher normally works quite a lot with the other guy.
Aaron Sorkin. He does.
And also what I like about Fincher is how you're talking about Pilot TV and being cinematic television. House of Cards is one, is like...
Yeah.
And also...
High Watermark and...
Manhunter. Which is basically a TV version of Seven.
In many ways, all based on true stories.
True stories, yeah. And Asif Kapadi as well, directing some of those.
He did, yeah.
Who I love. Engagement score, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, you stick with it. It is, you know, gripping, and you sort of want to work it out. And really, really engaging. But I'll go 4.5.
Helen,
I'm going to go for 5 on this one. I mean, it's, you cannot be gripped in what is going to happen next. And you know, it's a 2-hour film, but it does not feel like 2 hours. Nothing is wasted. There's no wasted shot. There's no lines that could have been cut. Mm-hmm. It's just so engaging, and you know, the performances are great, and you just have to find out what happens in the end.
It pulls you through. 4.5 for me, I think. 4.5. I don't know why I can't give it 5. Yeah. But it's you know,
and you can.
I can do.
At least no one's stopping you.
I can do, but it's not quite there.
It leaves a very heavy average. Still very impressive average.
Yeah, 4.57, which is fucking huge.
Pretty high.
I think that might be in the top 3.
Yeah.
Good.
What we do in the shadows is 4.7, I think.
Wow.
It's 4.6. And what we do, the Hunt for the Wilder People is also up there. So I think those...
You've got a real big thing for
Taika Waititi.
Taika Waititi, yeah. Big fans, Jesus. Fans of him.
Short
yeah.
films.
Okay.
Under, well, What We Do in the Shadows is pretty short. But 4.5 is pretty strong. I don't think we've had one.
We haven't had that one, anything that big for a long time. Fargo is up there.
Yeah. Can't not Fargo.
No.
Yeah, pretty top 5, isn't it? We're looking at.
Good. Okay.
Shall we see what the world of Twitter made and spoiled for Josh?
For Josh.
We're sorry, Josh.
Yeah, so we reach out to people on Twitter before we go to recording. We say, you know, we're reviewing Seven with Boyd Hilton, Josh Landy from Arsenal Podcast and Pilot TV Magazine. Have you seen it? Give us your thoughts for an on-air shout-out on FlixWatcher. And we've had a decent response from this, which I expected. So the first one is from Well, Boyd, can you take it from the top, please?
Top film tip?
Yep.
Yes, rookie and retiring detectives are entangled in sadistic serial killer sin-stalking tapestry. Good little sentence description there. David Fincher's Noir Deluge. I love this, yeah. Deft, stone-cold classic, absolutely. Better than every serial killer detective movie before or since. Big words, but I think I agree.
Yeah. So top film tip, if you like little pithy synopses on films, then he's a friend of ours, and he...
Oh, okay.
You
know,
yeah.
No, that's a good... You're right, pithy, very pithy.
Yeah. Josh, you want to take the second one?
Well, we should point out his excellent use of emojis which were a bit of a spoiler. We're sorry about that.
So
that
five heads out of five boxes.
I was wondering at first why I was being... It was great. That Fresh to Death said, 5 stars, a masterpiece by Fincher, Pitt, Freeman, Spacey and Paltrow, one of the all-time best endings, plot twists.
Without going into any of the spoilers, but it's up there, isn't it, for endings? It's simply
absolutely, yeah. Because what I love about the ending is it's not a twist; it's just an incredibly shocking, surprising thing that you don't see coming. That's the genius of it. It's not like a cliched twist. It's not like you know who the killer is, so it's not even a whodunit at that point.
No.
It's a what the fuck is he doing?
The only thing. I mean, it's very difficult because I had got the ending before I watched it, which I said about. But then I was thinking, What's the reason for her character if she doesn't later become somehow involved? And that was the only thing, because there aren't really spare people in this film don't then become involved in some way. So there was just that element, and the reason for that conversation about when she reveals to Freeman that she's pregnant, you're thinking maybe this, but then it's difficult because I only watched it knowing. But I was thinking maybe you think it comes back in somewhere.
The next tweet that you're about to read is very... I'm glad you're reading this because it's a very important point it makes.
Helen's reading this.
Oh, I'm going for this one.
Yeah.
So this is from Lee at Cinema List. The use of clothes is very clever. Pitt wears clothing too big for him to make him appear more boyish and less experienced. Also, Paltrow is mentioned 3 times in secondary conversation in the third act to subliminally remind us of her readiness for the conclusion.
So that's what you're saying, Josh.
Yeah, and that's a really... But the really interesting point is, they so cleverly do it so that you kind of forget about her a bit, enough for you not to be thinking all the time, oh, it's going to be... She's going to have her head in a box or anything. But they remind you just about enough off screen for you to remember her. And her scenes are so well done. I'll keep going about it, but she's so brilliant. Her scenes are so well scripted. She's so not just an addendum to him. She's a proper, kind of a three-dimensional, believable character in the very few scenes she does. It's just such a brilliant thing.
And that was 5 stars. I mean, yeah, there's so much information you get from her. You get that she's not happy. Yeah. She used to be a teacher. Mm. Obviously, there's...
And she's not happy because the schools that she's applied to are, like, she
horrible.
Not in the city, she doesn't like a lot of it. It's about the horrendous kind of, the alienation of the city. Yeah.
And I was going to put... There's been one film that's come before this, which is probably, I'd say, on par, which is the original Manhunter, the Michael Mann film, which I think would stand nicely in a double bill with this.
Don't like that film.
I would say Silence of the Lambs. I know there are a lot of... I'm not saying you're one. A lot of hipsters say Manhunter's better than the best portrayal of Hannibal Lecter. I still think Silence of the Lambs is the
absolute... I found it laughable.
But
I did.
I like Manhunter, but I still think Silence of the Lambs is the other, for me, big genre serial killing film that deserves...
Films, completely different takes on it.
Yeah,
I like them both.
I like them both as well, but I do think Silence is...
Boy, do you want to say this last one?
This is Film Me Up 2 Reviews. Perfect plot, captivating characters and vivacious visuals.
Oh, gone alliterative there, haven't they?
I might not have picked the word vivacious, but fine. A winning combination. Yes, absolutely.
Vivid visuals, it would have been an easier... lower hanging fruit.
Vivacious is...
Maybe they typed that and it auto-corrected to... Maybe they typed that.
I mean, and then Film Me Up 2 Reviews, which seems very nice, but have let themselves down with the 4.5 out of 5 mark, which is obviously wrong.
We've seen here it's 4.6 at least.
Yeah, but your calculations are just too difficult.
We've got some more.
Well, the final one sort of gave it away to me, I would say. If you just scroll down the one from Neil Wilson, we all know it's a wife's head in the box. Just in case you hadn't worked it out from the emojis of five female heads followed by five boxes.
Yeah, all very well saying it now, Neil Wilson.
But I mean, that's not really cheers, Neil Tricks. A review.
No,
it wasn't. It just it's wanted to say stuff.
It just came up on the timeline.
Cool. Guys, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kobe. It's been a joy.
And can you sign off by letting people know where they can find you online, Twitter, Instagram, or otherwise?
Of course. If you want to listen to Boyd and I's podcast about Arsenal, it's called Footballistically Arsenal. If you type that in on iTunes or SoundCloud or Acast, you will find us. Or you can just go to @ArsenalPodcast on Twitter or Footballistically Arsenal on any podcast platform, really.
Cool. Thank you very much, guys. Oh, sorry, Boyd. You need to start.
Thanks.
Yeah. Boyd needs a while, I tell you.
At Boyd Hilton on Twitter and Instagram. And lots of pictures of me with famous people, if you like that kind of thing. Me name dropping. It's like visual name dropping. It's my main purpose of my Instagram. And yes, Footballistically Arsenal, GQ Strike, every fortnight, General Football, Basic Binges at...
Is your Pilot TV. Your Twitter account is, your profile is you and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, isn't it?
It is, yeah, currently. I change it around sometimes, yeah. She's my all-time
legend. She's one of my
favourites. Yeah, yeah.
Veep is fantastic.
Yeah, and Seinfeld, obviously.
Yeah.
And I'm at Boyd Hilton. Did I say that? Which is just my name, literally my name.
All right, guys.
Thanks for coming
up. Thanks very much. Thanks for letting me drone on about Seven.
No worries. Bye.
Bye.
Cheers, guys. You were just listening to the latest episode of Flix Watcher Podcast. Thank you to Brendan Russell for his sublime editing skills. Mighty people for the tunes you can hear right now. Please do come to iTunes and find us, like, subscribe, share with your friends. Find us on Twitter @FlixWatcherPod and our website, flixwatcher.tv.